Hi, and welcome to this episode of the VFX Show. I'm Mike Seymour, and we are going on track with, well, Matt, which team would you be on if you were in Formula One?
Oh, that's a good question. I would say, you know, I'd want to be on like the Saab team or the Volvo team, but I don't think they race F1.
No. So that would be Matt, not in the paddock.
I'd want to be on the Swedish team or something, you know?
And Jason Diamond, which team would you be on if you're in a Formula One team?
Just to clarify, Matt, Volvo's owned by a Chinese company now, so you would actually not be with the Swedish team.
Oh,
you'd
darn.
Be with the Chinese team. I don't say that.
That's cool, though.
Qualifyingly, I'm just updating your records. I don't know. I think, is Lotus still a thing?
Yeah, wow, you guys aren't really F1 fans. So now we've established that we're doing the F1 show, and we have yes. only one person here who's a fanatical F1 fan, and two
That's
people who
sure.
want to either be with Volvo or with Lotus, which neither of which are on track. So good. Okay, well, let's start by discussing the film. Now we've set the agenda of deep dives. Let's start with discussing the film as a film before we get into the visual effects of Apple's F1. And so, Matt, what did you think of it as a film?
Well, I will admit I was excited to see this. I do have a weird soft spot for racing movies.
Okay.
I like the idea of the controlled and compact nature of racing. You know, whether it's cars, motorcycles, what have you, like on a track where you're vying for you know the top spot, the checkered flag, as it were. And I thought this was actually pretty great, like as a movie overall. Like if I was, you know, 12 or 13 years old, I bet I would have walked out of this movie. It's the greatest movie I've ever seen. You know, as a 55-year-old, you know, cinephile who's seen
curmudgeon.
Way too many movies, it's not a great original movie, like in terms of the writing and the story arc and stuff like that. But it is, you know, in the sort of Hitchcockian way, like it's a great example of pure cinema. It's pure visual storytelling. And the way they covered the racing scenes, the overall kind of kinetic energy of the edit, the brilliant use of the announcer to like heighten the tension mm-hmm. and to keep you sort of geographically located and understanding where you are in a race, where these races are 70 some odd laps in length, I think, right? I thought all that stuff was great. The effects, for the most part, are pretty good. There's a couple shots in one part that we can talk about that were terrible. I was shocked when I saw them in the show. But it made me think a lot about... have you guys ever seen the John Frankenheimer 1968 Grand Prix?
There's I have, but a long time ago. Yeah.
And there's you just shared the opening with us.
Yeah, the opening montage is done by Saul Bass, right? And mm-hmm. Saul Bass is famous for doing all these great title sequences for Hitchcock movies and stuff. And they do this amazing optical printing gag, like the opening, the camera comes out from black and it reveals that we're looking down the tailpipe of... you know, a Grand Prix, I guess they were supposed to be Formula One cars of the time, right? In the 60s. And then they do all this kind of optical printing where there's multiple images on the screen at the same time. And it comes down to the heartbeat of the racer. You hear the racer's heartbeat as they
there's like
kind
step
of cut.
Printing in there too.
Yeah, step printing. And then it goes to the green light and the race begins. And I thought there were a lot of similarities. I couldn't help but think, like, you know, Joseph Kaczynski and the filmmakers, like, they know that movie and they've watched that sequence because there was definitely an homage to it in it. And I thought, too, which we can get into a little bit more, but I thought the casting of all the secondary characters, like not the Brad Pitt and the Javier Bardem, they're fine, whatever, you know, they're serviceable, they do their jobs. But all the, like, the Sarah Niles who played the mom, who was in Catastrophe with Sharon Horgan on Amazon? Carrie Conn.
Wasn't she also in Ted Lasso?
Oh, in Ted Lasso, yes, yeah, she was great. She's got so much charisma on screen. She's a great character actor. Carrie Condon from Banshees of Inisherin was mm-hmm. great, I thought. And then I thought the breakout role was the Damson Idris as the Joshua character. Great. He was really, really good. And he really came across as kind of that cocky, arrogant kid. And his character arc, sort of classic hero's journey, I think it was really great. So I go too far here, but I really enjoyed it.
Don't forget the ops guy from who plays the Russian guy.
Yeah, from Killing Eve, yeah.
Yeah.
But yeah, I really liked it. It was fun.
So, Jason, again, what did you think of the film just as a film?
Were you finished, Matt?
Sorry. I went on too long, rambling. Yeah.
No, it's cool. similar to Matt, I actually really loved this movie. I was super pumped for it. It was the other, like, kind of non-superhero or otherworldly kind of movie, you know, that I was interested in this year. Mission Impossible 8, which you've already talked about and won't go into, and this one F1 more than delivers. And as previously established, I don't know shit about racing. Like, you know, I mean, I've seen car, you know, varying Daytonas and other things throughout my life, but I don't know the sport. I don't know the minutia of it. I've read a bunch of stuff online where people are like, oh my God, if this had happened in a real F1, this plot point couldn't have happened. And they like destroy the plot. And I know for a fact, any one of us have done this with any other movie that we are intimately involved with the specifics of that plot. So I will say I am the uneducated F1 viewer, movie viewer who absolutely loved it. It is a return to form for Jerry Bruckheimer. That is for sure. This is a Bruckheimer. His fingerprints are all over this movie, and it's great because this is what he does. And I think it was very smart for him to be a part of this, although obviously he was part of Top Gun and all that stuff, you know, the remake. But to your point, Matt, and I brought my son, who's 18 and doesn't know anything about F1, and his friend, and I went with my brother and another friend, and we were just like second row of a really giant screen, and we might as well have had steering wheels on our seats, you know, like we were like in the cars.
Yeah.
And everything you said is spot on. The editing, the camera work, which we can get into, the things they did for the little pan gags in the cars, which is amazing.
So cool.
And yeah. And you know what? Honestly, the plot is fine.
Yeah.
Like it is exactly the plot for a giant popcorn blockbuster movie. And every shot is how cool can we remind you that Brad Pitt is? Every shot. So, you're like, oh, I think I might have forgotten. Oh, nope, I didn't. There he is. He's super cool.
Okay, so I'm the established F1 fan.
Yes.
Like I literally have a cable subscription just to watch F1 races on and nothing else. And it's a four-day event for me, right? There's like practice, multiple practice sessions, then there's qualifying, then there's the race. So like I'm in, right? And I think there are many aspects about Formula One that make it really interesting, not least of which is, and it's captured a bit in this film, there are, you know, depending on which season you're in, like 20 seats, right? 10 teams, 20 seats. That's it. And there aren't many sports where, like if you think about tennis, there are like hundreds of players of which you tend to know the top players at any one time, right? And of course there's F2 and F3, but at F1 level, there's just these 20 people. You kind of know them all. And even if you didn't know them all, Drive to Survive has meant that we do now know them all. And I think there was a bunch of things that you could say about this, but it's a really difficult line, and I'm not the first to say this, between satisfying the hyper fan like me, who's like, wait a second, you really don't discuss qualifying. And critics of F1 will say, especially Monaco, the race in Monaco, that whoever comes first and second and third in qualifying wins the race, right? It's almost so impossible to overtake around the streets of Monaco that qualifying is like almost more important than the race in a sense. I mean, it isn't, right? But, it's like
on qualifying. If you get that pole position, you're in.
You're in, yeah. And so for a super fan, right? Like there are things in this that are absurd, and there are some things that are acceptably absurd, and there are other things that are just funny absurd, right? But by the same token, like if you go the other way and you don't understand F1 at kind of a deep level, then you have to be brought into the sport in a way that lets you kind of appreciate a whole lot of it without having to have like 16 minutes of exposition before every race to explain stuff. And structurally, it's a problem for the filmmakers that they had to tackle a bunch of things, and they also set themselves up difficult problems. Like, I heard one critic upset that they were like, well, you've got 9 races to achieve their goal. So you know there are 9 races coming. So in the film, you just sit there ticking off, okay, well, now we've got 8 left, now we've got 7 left, now we've got 6 left. I didn't feel that at all, right? That wasn't a problem for me.
And you could do that in like a, you could find 100 movies where you've been set up with a task list that you're figuring out how to get through.
And yes, it's Top Gun all over, right? It's like you've got the senior female role, and she's going to fall in love with the male role, and the male guy's a bit cocky, and he's coming back, and he's a bit of a bad boy, and all of that. But the other thing that they were dealing with is it hasn't actually been very easy to make successful racing movies. Like, there's a lot of, I mean, I don't know if you guys remember Days of Thunder with Cruise and stuff, but like that wasn't considered like a really great success. There wasn't, and that had everything in it, right? Nicole Kidman, there was like huge amounts of everything.
Tony Scott,
similar kind of big popcorn-y kind of film. So, and the problem, not least of which, is you've just got a bunch of guys in cars going around in circles for like, you know, a fair while. And normally they don't overtake much. And you have to be really sussing the subtleties. And, you know, races are won and lost on strategy over tire changes. Not how fast they do them, you understand, just like which rubber you're using. And and there's a limited number of the same tires each team has, right? So it's like, so it's a very constrained problem. And the strategy of when you come in and go out and do all that kind of stuff, it's like, it's very, very complicated. It's both a team sport because the strategy is being worked out by the team as to when they can and where the other people are. And even on qualifying, like, could you get a clear run now that you're not going to get traffic at some other point on the track so that it'll slow you down during your qualifying lap? Because they're all out kind of different points on the, all of that's team. And then you've got just one person in the car who's kind of trying to deliver. And they are very much the employee of the team, which isn't really great movie making, right? Like, you will have very rarely a driver go against team instructions. So if the team says pit now, they will, right? They don't just, they say, you know, go in now, box, box, box. They're not going to go, no, I'm going to stay out for another 10 laps because I'm
just a maverick. But that's what makes them a bad boy.
Yes, but that's not what sort of happens, right? It'd be like a...
Yes, of course.
I presume in NFL, if you like were getting calls from the coach from the sideline and they just ignore them all and decide to do their own moves, you'd be like, well, that's just not how it's played. So here's the trouble, right? So if you know a thing really well and they make a movie about it, like, you have problems with it, right? There's a movie coming out that we're going to discuss, and it has a big sailing sequence in it. And I am sitting there in the cinema just going, oh, my God, what are they? They're backing the main. Like, this is ridiculous. Like, they're not sailing, you know. Because if you know about a thing in a movie, but then if you don't know about it, like, if I saw a movie about NFL football, I'd be like, Any Given Sunday. I think the greatest film ever, Any Given Sunday. There's not a problem with that film as far as Any Given Sunday, one of my all-time favorite films.
I come from
films,
a
right?
family of lawyers and judges, and they can. I always loved watching the original Law and Order when it was on TV, and if my dad was ever visiting or I was visiting him and he saw that was on, he's like, oh, I got to leave the room. He couldn't watch any of that stuff. He's like, it's terrible.
No, John Grisham family movies,
No.
But there are other aspects about this one that I thought were really funny. And a really good one is there's a scene at the end when the guys are walking through the paddock at the end, and you've got a major Formula One star walking through the paddock and no one is stopping him for selfies. No one's stopping him for autographs, right? Like, no one's bothering them whatsoever. It's like these people are rock stars in their world. And so anyway, in all of that context, to navigate between the person that doesn't know and the person that does, to try and get a film that is actually successful as a racing film, which is difficult, to actually overcome the kind of complexity of like the nuances of how they actually win a race versus the kind of broad brushstrokes you need for an action movie. And then there's one last point that made it really, really hard, which is this film is obviously an F1 promotional item, which is fine, right? It's like, we had no problem with Top Gun promoting joining the Navy as an aviator. But they couldn't have one of the other teams as a villain because none of the other teams nor their sponsors would want there to be the villain. And the obvious villain would be Max Verstappen, world reigning champion when this was shot, in Red Bull, right? He's he's the hard, most hardcore goddamn driver ever. Like, he is so hardcore. But no one is going to allow Max to be portrayed as an evil guy, yeah, or a bad guy, or somebody that breaks the rules and does the wrong thing by Sonny. So it's completely valid, by the way, to have rivalry between two members in the same team. Like, that's a really valid Formula One story. But it was hard because normally you'd have evil, conniving, bastard, black, yeah, you know, the black red Baron, and you've got the, you know, the white car and the black one, and you're going to, they're going to like play dirty, and, you know, it's, and in almost all other kind of fully fictional sporty type things like this, you have the evil team you're trying to beat, or the guys that don't play by the rules, or they're the rich team and we're the up and coming. And so they've got every other Formula One team there, but none of them are bad guys. So I actually think, so
you make it the owners, which is,
yeah, yeah. But even then, totally, it's not valid, the same, is it? Because the owners aren't on the, you know, you don't have anyone sabotaging cars.
No, it's the faceless. No, it's just the, yeah, faceless corporate. The pressures, but
did,
of the faceless.
They did make in the narrative structure, though, they did make it like kind of a, there was this sort of battle between generations. You know, there's this older.
Yeah, but that's inside your team. You can't, yeah, have a rival team, like a,
right,
they're, yeah, the bad guys over there. Yeah, they're, yeah, going to sneer at. They're going to be the ones that, you know, like, yeah. I mean, they try to introduce that by having the owner come up with leaking amendment to the cars that would cause it
or something.
But it's like, normally, yeah, that would be the other team, right? That would pull a dirty stunt, and you'd be, right, like, those bastards, we'll get them.
Well, I guess the question is did you like the movie? Because I don't know if we heard that from you.
Well, I did like the movie because of, but I liked the movie mainly because I was spotting all of these people. Like, I was getting really excited by people that my wife was sitting there going, right, what are you going on about, right?
Yeah.
Like, and if you know these people really real, I mean, I'm a huge fan of like a whole bunch of these people. That's the other thing. It's not one person. Like, I do like George Russell and I like Hamilton and I like a bunch of drivers, but it's not like there's one person that I was rooting for that's my team. It's like but there's a load of people behind the scenes. Will Buxton is one of the commentators, and he's since left to go to IndyCars. And like, when I saw him on the screen, I was like, oh, that's Will. Like, because he's now left, right? And my wife's like, who? I'm like, okay, don't worry. Yeah. So,
like, if Kaczynski does a golf movie next, I'm your guy. Like,
yeah, exactly, right? Like, but if they made a golf movie, I would know nothing, and I would be like, oh, okay, so they play 17 holes. Okay, cool. Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah. Can I say, as the completely uneducated side of this argument, what I found really intriguing about the plot, about the script, rather, structure, as Matt had said, is that, as they should, and very well executed, they trained me to understand what key moments meant and when they got better to cheer for them, and when they didn't work out, to immediately understand this was bad without diving into minutiae and exposition. And I found, like, they do like three in the beginning, first act, they basically like show the younger blonde pit, like, you know, tire person, like, kind of screw up, and like, they got stuck in the pit for a long time, and then when they finally did a pit change in like, you know, 2 seconds, and they were all cheered, you're like, yes, they did it, right? Like, I don't, like, sure, obviously I understand the mechanics of needing to get in and out of the thing fast,
yeah,
but
the only thing I'd say about that is, why did it have to be a woman, right? Like, it was just fair. There are so, yeah, few women in the pit. And to have one of the few women on the pit crew that makes a mistake, it just felt really like, you know, the not very talented woman that had somehow got to the, I
agree with you 100%.
But I agree with you saying, yeah, you needed to understand that if you could actually make 2 seconds, that would be really newsworthy, and that,
yeah,
2.3 and 2.5 is what you're hoping, yeah, for. And yeah.
So using that as an example, there is any number of those types of mechanical things that happen in a race that a racing fan understands inherently, and that the audience, and let's just assume that at least 50% of the audience going to the movies doesn't know anything about.
Oh yeah.
Is like a F1 fanatics, right? We'll just,
but see, I think they learned an enormous amount from Drive to Survive. Because Drive to Survive got,
oh, I'm sure,
very, very good at having the commentators So what they do on Drive to Survive, and they obviously did this because it's fictional, but on Drive to Survive, let's say I've got a Netflix documentary. So they've got a race going on, yeah? And you're trying to piece together the narrative for the audience. And so they got the actual commentator that commentated the actual race, and they intercut their actual commentary, like he's overtaken him, with another bit where he says, the trick will be to see if he can overtake him. That'll be the thing.
Right.
And they re-recorded that bit like years later, or you know, months later, and then stuck it in right before the actual commentary. So you've set up what's going to happen.
Yeah.
Because in the race, when you're actually watching it, they're not constantly saying, you know, what will be really important in the next minute is for this guy to do this. It's like they're reacting. Yeah, yeah. But in the Drive to Survive, they're very good at setting those things up. And I think that's what they do here.
Yeah, I think they do that incredibly well here to have, you know, so we went to see it on Sunday in the afternoon. And then at 10:30 at night, the same night, my son went and saw it again with a bunch of his friends who wanted to see it. And he was pumped. Like he was pumped to see it like 5 hours later. Right. And just, we were talking about it today at lunch, like, just now he's a film guy because he's in film school and we were geeking out about all the film making stuff. But just from a storytelling thing, like he just really got it. And he doesn't know anything about racing, right? So it's like.
So can I get, maybe Matt, you could jump in on this. What did you think of because you mentioned that Le Mans and you know, some of the early things. What did you think of the original Daytona sequence? Because the Daytona sequence is set up to kind of show that Sonny is like still able to drive really well, but not in Formula One. Because we don't want him to be a drunk, in which case no one would believe he would have the you know, coordination skills.
I mean, I think as a thing in the narrative structure, as a character building thing, like, you know, they did the job they needed to do of kind of he's sort of like the old sage. He's been doing it a long time. He's been scarred and wounded, you know, like he's struggled, you know, like all those things are in it. And so he's got this redemptive arc that you're sort of wanting to see happen. I thought, you know, they set him up in a way where it seemed believable. And then the flashback to, you know, when he's in the Camel sponsored a Formula One car where he has his big accident, they sort of have the flashback sequence, which they did a good job too of even like, you know, all the stylistic things they do to make it look like older footage with the video signal breakup and all that kind of stuff.
And the de-aging and stuff. Yeah.
Yeah. It was cool. You know, like it totally works.
That was Martin Donnelly's crash in 91 and where he never came back from it, but he did survive. But yeah.
I thought all that stuff worked really good. I you know, I was going to say in the context of the narrative, before we dig more deep into the effects part of it, like in the narrative, the one thing that I was imagining was going to happen is what happened was the opposite of what I expected in the end of the movie. So big spoiler alert here, but like I sort of imagined that what was going to happen was that Brad Pitt was going to have a choice of either winning or like sort of, you know, taking a chance and maybe winning or having an opportunity to help his teammate win. And I sort of thought they were going to go.
And the third thing is the whole like Rocky style, if you get punched again, you could die, go blind. You know, there's the health aspect.
Yeah.
Sure, you could win, but you might die. Sure, you could help someone even, but you might die or go blind, whatever. So that was like
I thought he was going to help the Joshua character win, and that his redemptive arc would be something different that was more selfless and more about the team. And in the end, like, it wasn't like he selfishly chose to win. There was another incident in the, you know, in the field that allowed him to sort of then take the lead and win.
Well, it was his teammate that allowed him to win, right?
But not on purpose, you know, like his teammate didn't crash on purpose, right? I mean, did he? I mean, I didn't, that's not what I, like,
No, I'm not saying that specifically, but I think to your point, they set it up enough that it's cloudy enough that he can win without it being some moral victory.
I guess it's like my son said this after we just saw it just today. And when we were having this conversation in the car with my wife and son, and I all went and we're talking in the car, and I said this very thing where I thought, oh, I kind of thought that he would sacrifice to let the young guy win. And that would be kind of his redemptive arc that he would, he's older. He's, you know, he's done everything he wanted mm-hmm. to do. And he becomes a part of the team as instead of being the lone wolf kind of cowboy gunman character or whatever. And when that didn't happen, I was sort of disappointed. My son, you know, I think in, you know, another film student, right? He says, well, those are two different movies, you know, with two different endings with two different mm-hmm. messages. And it's like, you know, but both are equally valid, but, you know, I suppose.
But just unpacking a comment that you made and I let slip, which Matt was appalling of me, is that you were like, Brad Pitt does a good enough job. But Brad Pitt is a rock star movie star. Like he has full on Hollywood old school and
100 million percent.
Yeah, and also he is now Steve McQueen. He's the Steve McQueen of our generation. And so for me, what I want Steve McQueen to do is then go off to the desert, leave Formula One, even though he could get a contract with Toto, buggies,
yeah.
and race dune buggies. Like, he is so cool. Like, in any other generation, he'd have crossed the finish line with a cigarette hanging out of his mouth, with a six-pack that he was ripping that he kept in the car, and he'd, you know, jump out and be mobbed by women in bikinis. Like, it was just Steve McQueen, right? it was just so cool.
I agree. He has the best plastic surgery of anyone his age, and it fucking works like a million
best hair,
percent.
The best hair, everything. The best smile, the best everything, right? Yeah, no, he's just like, and no, it's like,
I mean, he's the dude. He is the dude for this
and
movie.
And when he's on the screen, if he was anything but that, I'd be so disappointed, right? Like, if he was anything but that cool, like if they'd made him like somehow immoral or not, or even just like, I don't know, he just had to walk away from that, but literally walk away from Formula One because he's so cool.
He pulls it off, but how many more years can he play that role?
Oh, God, please. Please be many.
I don't know.
I'm with you, Mike.
I guess that's where we differ. Like, I kind of feel like it's exciting to see these newer actors, younger actors coming up who I haven't seen in as many things, and to give the hero's journey. You know, do I need to see the old guy do it again? You know, like Tom Cruise saving the world again, Brad Pitt like winning.
I would argue that Tom's probably gone one film too many, as I think I said on that podcast. Yes. But
they're almost same age.
Yeah, Brad wins it in this one. I tell you, Brad.
Oh, he
Brad
takes rules. The summer. Like between him and him and I mean, he wins the summer. I mean, for sure. Like, this movie's going to stay in the theaters a lot longer than Mission Impossible 8. That is for sure.
Don't get me wrong. It's a really good movie. It's super fun. But like,
it's also not a franchise, right? It's not true. A remake or not a franchise. It is actually, like, it's a summer blockbuster, but it's not at what?
Jason? Although Kaczynski did say that he was considered, he would love to do an F, I don't know, he wouldn't call it F2 because that's demotional, but a sequel where he would blend, do a crossover with Days of Thunder and Tom Cruise.
Okay, maybe. But my point is, at the moment, this film comes to us not as a...
Yeah, yeah, it's not set up as a thing.
The eighth film in the franchise. It's not coming to us as this is the cartoon that we're remaking the live action version of. So it is...
And Damson Idris came from Snowfall, from that series, which I think is an FX series.
Don't get me wrong. I think he's great, right? I think Joshua's character is great, and I think Kerry's character is great, right?
I was so happy that they did not cast like a super hot 28-year-old in the Kerry Condon role and just try to like she's
totally agree with that.
She is perfect for the role. She's a beautiful woman, and she is an incredible actress, and the Irish accent sort of she's Irish, the other guy's English, Javier Bardem's Spanish, you know, like it's sort of,
and
like
actually,
it brought more of an international vibe to the movie.
Hannah Smith at Red Bull and Bernie Collins, like these are women in Formula One and they are probably, younger than Kerry is. Like there would be a precedence for having someone slightly younger. And those women are also very good looking in the real world. But my point is, I totally agree with you. We just did not want, you know, a Kardashian in that role. We wanted somebody that like could act and that actually was plausible.
Yeah.
Well, and that she's the engineer too, you know, like that's the other part that's really cool.
She's a literal rocket scientist.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So my question to you then is, leaving all that aside, Yeah.
Yes.
How good was that cinematography? I mean, the visual effects point of view, like the effort they went to use Formula 2 cars and then to use Formula 1 cars and reskin them, which is Frameworks. Like, I think Frameworks, unbelievably good job in, like, because I'm sitting there studying and it's now.
Framestore?
Framestore, sorry. What did I say? Frameworks. I'm sorry. I mean, yes, Framestore. My apologies. Framestore did an unreal job in reskinning those cars. And obviously, that's how you could get toe-to-toe with, like, some of the other Red Bull or whatever cars, because you're not going to have – they did have Brad Pitt and they, you know, did have the guys racing in real cars around real tracks in between, you know, sessions at Formula mm-hmm. One. But if you're going to have toe-to-toe car work, the best way to do that was to get two Formula One cars and just reskin one of them. Like, the Williams car was then turned into the Apex car with visual effects. And I thought that worked really well. But it worked really well because it was combined with, I think, spectacularly good camera work.
Incredible camera work.
My friend who's a cinematographer was sitting between my brother and I, and we all looked at each other and said that, you know, Claudio Miranda and Kaczynski are like they have the Tony Scott vibe, but are like the more technical, cleaner technical version of Tony Scott, not the mushy emotional version Jeffrey Kimball, you know, vibes of,
I think,
of Tony Scott.
Yeah. And I think Kaczynski too, like in conjunction with his cinematographer on this show, like, but even on all his other films, like he's a visual stylist in the vein of a Ridley Scott, you know? I mean, you mm-hmm. mentioned Tony Scott, you know? I think there's definitely a sense of taste, an incredible sense of composition mm-hmm. and like movement, you know, through the frame. I mean, that's what I meant at the very beginning when I was talking about, you know, there's that Truffaut Hitchcock interview book and then the documentary of them talking to each other. And, you know, that's one of the things Hitchcock brings up is that idea of pure cinema where, you know,
yeah.
he shows, what is it, in Vertigo, you see at the beginning, Jimmy Stewart, you know, jumping across from one rooftop to the other and he's hanging and you see the montage of like the hands gripping on the rain gutter, the feet swinging. Then you see the wide shot, like, and it's all visual. Like, mm-hmm. you know, you could watch this movie, I would argue, that I just saw today. I was thinking and walking out of the theater, that was the first thing that popped into my head was pure cinema. And I think you could watch this movie with no sound. I would be kind of boring without sound because the sound design is amazing. Dialogue. Yeah, with no dialogue. You could watch that movie and you would understand everything that was going on. And that's, I think, a test for something that's so kinetic and that's, you know, 230 mm-hmm. plus miles an hour. To be able to say that, you know where you are, you know what's going on, you have a sense of what's happening.
Yep.
You know, that's an amazing feat of both the cinematography, but obviously in conjunction with the editing, the pre-planning, yeah. the boarding, the previs of all of it. And it's just such a high bar, technically.
The editing, I mean, they should 100% get an Oscar nod for editing for this film. Like, I mean, it's so stellar and clean and the cuts are so fast and it's register everything,
too, you know?
Yeah. I think the sound design, like every time a car passes, there's a huge push in the subs in the theater. Like Dopplers in,
yeah.
you know, like there's so many subtle little things happening. But I have to say, and I said it before, those modified FX6 cameras where they just like chop the, I mean, they didn't just do this. Obviously Panavision worked with Sony to make micro cameras, but essentially they made a even lighter, smaller Rialto and took the front off
They did a sensor on a stick.
Yeah, essentially. And put it on these pan motors that they could pan with a Preston hand unit. A follow focus.
Wasn't it amazing having a Preston motor on a pan head?
Yeah.
That was that's controlled.
The whip. That those are the whip pans yeah. that go yeah. from the yeah. road view Which to are, the cockpit view.
Or and they're pulling focus. Yeah.
Yeah. Any number
And it's a full frame sensor, so you get the shallow yeah. depth of field. So it's a full frame 14 4K.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, if you've not tuned into some of the tech stuff that's been discussed, just for people listening. So like there are cameras in the cars normally, but the cameras in the cars have two problems. Firstly, they can't obviously change the wind profile of the car, so they can't stick out. But then they also have to transmit, because what you want from a Formula One race is to see what's happening right now. So they took out all the transmitting stuff, which gave them back space to actually mount the bigger sensor part. And then they had to hide the recording part somewhere else on the car.
Bodies, yeah.
Yeah. And then, of course, they also did stick cameras where they would actually cause problems with the wind.
So it was a mixture of, I think they had they said they had 15 camera positions, and they would,
around the car. Yeah.
For the panning ones, and they would use four at any given time.
Yeah.
And then they worked with Apple to basically take an iPhone apart for all intents and purposes and build these 4K cameras into the wind foil kind of aerofoil spots where they normally put their like kind of crappier, you know, lower res non-high tech cameras with like recording to log ProRes in this like wing thing, because I think Claudio Miranda said to Apple, like, hey, I can already do this. I have it in my pocket. Can you just put it in this thing? And they did, and they made like a whole iPad interface for them and whatever. And I think that is, you know, there's a lot of conversation about tech companies being a part of movie making now. And I think this might be the best sort of mixture of a tech company and a filmmaker coming together to solve very technical but also, you know, creative problems that makes it more visceral.
Well, that's a really interesting thing as you're talking. I mean, it starts my brain going too. Like, this is probably the biggest Apple Films release.
It is. $300 million.
Yeah.
Mind you, and we'll come to that in a minute, with great product placement to offset some of the budget.
Oh,
for sure. Yeah, totally. But cinema displays, yeah. Going, XDR displays. But I think that's a really interesting thing, is like having a budget. I mean, you can see that budget on screen. I feel like, absolutely. You know, the world building, I don't follow F1, but the way in which it feels like, you know, all those, the different teams, their little pods at these race events there. Mm-hmm. You feel like you're in like a high-end luxury designer store, you know, walking into these clean white spaces, and it's all beautifully lit, and they have all this high-tech equipment and stuff.
And that's Kaczynski for sure. Yeah.
Total. No, that's what that's like though. So there's two things, right? There's the where they are on the track, and they apex, the fake team, was sometimes between Ferrari and Mercedes in the middle, which is, again, not where they would be, because they'd be down the end if they were a low-ranked team. But nevertheless, it's right there in the middle of the major teams. And then they have like their trailer homes, effectively, which are in the section of the paddock. And that trailer section, these pop-up buildings, are exceptionally nice. I mean, I think the one in this is slightly nicer than anyone's ever done, ever. But they had two, right? They had a small one the first year they were filming and a bigger one the second year they were filming. But they are like, they are no doubt some of the nicest portable things. But the mechanics the logistics of building that in a weekend, and then they have two whole versions of this. So you leapfrogging. So the one that's in this location doesn't go to the next race because it's not time for it to get there. It goes to the one after that. But nevertheless, you've got this kind of leapfrogging event. But moving that much gear and setting it up, it's like setting up for a, you know, U2 concert every weekend.
Yeah.
Because you've got to build everything and bring in everything, and it's astounding.
I mean, I saw a thing with Bruckheimer where he said they basically, you know, they made the deal with F1, the organization, obviously, and they were the 11th team on the track. They had their own garage and went to every event and built their garage and did their shit and did it when they needed to do it. And a friend of mine who knows some crew members on this movie said that one of the issues they had, and Mike, you could confirm this, the specifics, but said they did a whole bunch of shooting, but then F1 changed a bunch of things on either the cars or decal placement. I don't know. There was some technical thing that changed enough that they had to go back and shoot a whole nother round of races. Another season of races.
There's a bit over the top of the driver's heads that they made mandatory, that is a life-saving thing if the car rolls and stuff. And I think that's what he's referring to. And it was because this is good to understand, we're talking in 25, this was shot in 23, 24, right? And so you're talking about rule changes that may have happened between 22 and 23 or in 23.
Yeah, 24. I don't know when they happened, but.
And that is obviously a consideration. But getting back to the visual effects specifically for a second and that cinematography, the other point that we just didn't mention is the vibration problem, because these cameras are on these cars and sometimes you want that really visceral, like shuddery kind of, you can't even sort of see what the hell you're looking at. How does a driver even know what he's looking at type shot? But most of the time you want a really smooth shot. And as I understand it, a lot of the vibration was mechanical and hand tweaked per setup, per track, right? They'd be like, okay, on this track, it's a bit rougher, blah, blah, blah. So we'd adjust all of the, they'd run the cars and see what the, this is on days when it wasn't the middle of F1. Yeah. On the days it was in the middle of F1, they had very, very precise windows. And I don't know if you heard the anecdote that Brad Pitt said, but he was, he had the first run out at Silverstone. They had exactly 20 minutes. That was it, right? And if they crashed the car, that would have put out the whole rest of the day, which is TV rights and everything else, because it would have delayed as they got the car off the track. So they had to get out, get back in, and they had to prove to F1 that they would be exactly 20 minutes, not 21, not 22, not 23. And so they did all the stuff, and he was sitting in the car, and it was between sessions, obviously, but they were going to be able to film him going around with all the crowds and all of the everything that would make it worthwhile. And they did all the checks. Everything was ready to go. And he was just sitting there waiting and they weren't rushed at all. And he just floors it out in the start of his 20-minute session and immediately his comms go out. So he has no comms on filming. And so he said, like on any other film, because you'd immediately stop and like, you know, my comms isn't working. But he had to do the whole thing. And of course, there was a lot of choreography between the cars and delivery of lines that he had to give at particular points in the track. And so he had to just do it all from memory. He had to do the whole thing where he did all the car moves, nailed it all at speed, delivering lines, looking left when he's meant to look left, looking right when he's meant to look right, depending where he is on the track. And that was it. They came in, the 20 minutes was over. And he was like, I didn't hear a thing anyone said. And but he nailed it. So
that's cool.
Olivier would call that acting.
Yeah. And interestingly, acting with your eyes, because you don't see their mouths. I was kind of stunned that they even bothered saying their lines in the car, but apparently they did.
I saw a thing with Damson Idris where he was like, I knew they were only seeing this. And I like realized like, oh, I saw some, you know, we were doing some test footage and I realized you couldn't tell if I was alive or dead. You know, like my face isn't moving because it's all my mouth. He's like, so I started moving my eyebrows and my eyes a lot. And he's like, I thought I was going over the top. And I come back around from the lap and they're like, oh, that's pretty good. But like, you need to do it a lot more. And he's like, how am I going to move my face that much?
You pantomiming know, like, the eye movements. You were talking about the sound, which I think is really incredible. I saw a piece because Lewis Hamilton, as you know, was the producer on this. Mm-hmm. And Lewis Hamilton wanted to be in Top Gun. And that's how it all started.
Oh,
interesting. Hamilton reached out for Top Gun and was going to be in it, but they couldn't make it work with the F1 schedule that he would obviously not miss an F1 race for a film prod. And so that's how he knew the director. And then when the director wanted to do the F1 film, he said, hey, Lewis Hamilton, which of course opens all the doors, right? Because Lewis Hamilton, you know, world champion and incredible, incredible driver. But what's really interesting, I saw a thing with Lewis Hamilton and I've also heard this recounted where he was listening to the soundtrack and he's saying, oh, you've got the wrong gear, because he could tell what gears the driver would be in based on the sound of the, and so he would edit them and say, you need to change that and change the, because at this corner, you wouldn't be on that gear. And I was thinking for a second, is that just PR hype or what? But I subsequently saw a session where they got the two McLaren drivers at the moment, one of who's in Australia, we're very proud of. And they gave them just the audio of their engines and said, can you pick which race this was out of the season? And both drivers 100% could pick which track it was just that's listening insane. To the gear changes of their motors. Cause they'd be like, okay, so that's been about, you know, X number of seconds and it's clearly gone down to seconds. So that would be that course, because that's the only one where you'd have such a sharp corner kind of thing. So, So it's being
a virtuoso, you know
your that's incredible. Right. Yeah.
So there is a real authenticity to the audio as much as there's an authenticity to the visuals.
Well, and I was talking to my kid about this, and again, neither of us know anything, but we know who Lewis Hamilton is, right? Like, you know the stars of a thing, even if you don't know the thing. And we were saying to each other, like, okay, aficionados may take issue with certain parts of the mechanics of F1, balanced against the plot. But the two of us said, okay, but Lewis Hamilton is a producer. So as a viewer who knows who Lewis Hamilton is, we assume that the plot is correct enough that he would allow it to pass through the filter of whatever, to your point about gear changes and whatever. Clearly, the issues that people had, the stuff that I had seen about, like, you know, rules about crashes or this or however, you know, things that drove the plot wouldn't happen or whatever. I was like, okay, may or may not be true. But if Lewis Hamilton says, yes, it's good, I'm good with it, right? He's the guy. Like,
he's giving it the thumbs up. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, there are.
But I want to go back.
Go on.
Oh, go ahead.
You were saying like, weird point. Like Lewis Hamilton, and they correctly did it, right? They got things right that mattered. The fact that that Sonny couldn't have got an F1 license because, or that you can't change drivers between qualifying and the main race, like technicalities that no audience member is going to care about, right? But you care that
it's not drama.
It feels fast.
But I wanted to go back to the cinematography because I mean, visual effects is, of course, you know, playing a role, solving problems for cinematography. So the cinematography is coming first in the creative cycle there. I'm not, you know, whatever. Yep. And so there is some, I found it interesting that I did not feel like any drone shots. It felt helicopter if it needed to be, like, you could feel it, at least in the way it felt on a big screen. Like, it didn't feel like a video game. At no point did it feel like a sort of, hey, we're going to use modern tools to do this thing. Like, to Matt's point, it had this classic cinematic language look to it. And good, I didn't point. Feel yeah. modern, you know, thumbs. Yeah,
they could have had a camera that went from one car to another car with an impossible camera move. That
you could have done
possible.
The War of the Worlds shot or something like that. And it's like, I feel like the panning, the mini panning cameras did so much work. And like every time it happened, I turned to my kid and we were like, sick, you know, because it's just, you know, from a technical standpoint, of course, but just they did it in such the right dramatic moment to, you know, like he spins out and then you're like, where am I? And then the camera goes whack, pans to the right and lands right on his face. And you're like, fuck, that is like, I know exactly where I am. I know exactly what's happening. And it's like a dope cinematic move. It's like such a clean solve.
And I know it's incredibly keeping the camera really grounded like that and having those kinds of camera moments. I think it's a smart choice, a directorial choice, DP choice, storytelling choice, because it has the direct effect, I think, of for the viewer, like we feel like we're actually there and it feels like everything's so grounded and the peril that they're in, you know, at these speeds, it feels so much more real. And I think it heightens all the cinematic, I mean, it sounds like film schooly, but it heightens all the cinematic tension in a way where, like, I mean, I had at one point, I was like, I should get up and, you know, go get some water or something. I'm pretty thirsty, but I couldn't get up and leave. Like, cause I was like,
yeah,
I don't want to miss any of this action. Cause
it's like what, 2.5
really
hours
fresh.
And it didn't drag.
2:35 or something.
Yeah.
No, not at all.
Okay. So we've looked at it from the perspective of a fan. By the way, John Montgomery here at FX Guide is like a way super fan than I am. Right. Like, I mean, I might have liked seeing Gunter Steiner or people like that. John is like, leaves me in the dust for like nuanced. He plays like, what is that, fantasy football type F1.
Oh, yeah.
Like, he's
F1
like,
fantasy
John
football.
Is,
that's good.
Yeah, but John is like next level. So
did
there are fans
it?
Way beyond me. Well, I can't tell you. I don't know. I just don't know the answer to my question. But my point is, so that's one whole thing. But the other side of it, so I'm like loving it. You guys are loving it. But we got to get back to Matt's visual effects. There are some shots I really didn't like. There are some that you thought were really bad. So here what is
it? Okay, here's the thing. Overall, I got to be honest. I don't know what the effect shots were in this movie. I mean, I could imagine the.
Well, hang on, you said earlier on this podcast that there was something that was really bad.
No, there's, but there is, there is two or three shots that in one sequence that I thought I was like, wait, what movie is this? Is this a commercial for like a car wash? Like these were really bad composites. But overall, before I get to that one, overall, I thought the effects were seamless, seamlessly integrated. I don't 100%. Know where, I don't know where the, you know, amazing technical cinematography started and ended, and where the effects started and ended, aside from maybe like the spinning car in the air. I assume that was a CG thing. And maybe some of the, like the bump up, the car getting bumped off the track at one point, like when another
maybe car hits, like, kind of and stuff pops like up. Yeah.
And some of that stuff I assume was effects. I don't know if, you know, there were full, I assume there must've been some shots of full cars that were effects on the racetrack. I don't know if the, you know, the sort of fuel, like backfire, not backfire, I don't know what that is, but the little pops
sparks coming out of the stuff,
back. Is that all practical? Is that real? Are those effects? They looked great. The shots that didn't look, not only did they not look great, they looked, I thought, terrible. And I hate to say it, because otherwise these are the only shots that stood out that way.
Suspense is killing me, yeah?
It's at the end of the movie, at the end of the last race, they're on fireworks. The The fireworks are going off. When you said the end of the
movie, yeah.
Yep. The fireworks are going off. They've won the race. He's won the race. And they're coming across, I don't know if it's the pit or the paddock area. They're walking. Yep. And the actors are in the foreground, and behind them are fireworks. And like, I was like, what is going on? Like the lighting is totally different. Like it's such a really bad roto comp thing. Like it was like, there were, I think, three shots, if I remember correctly. And they all were kind of the same perspective, and they're all cheering as they're kind of like, yay, you know, super excited. And the fireworks are going off in the background, and just the cutout around each actor was like, it was swimming, and like, it 100%. Looked so, they just, it took me right away. It took me out of the movie. And I was like, what is this? Like,
it felt like Die Hard 2 when he pulled the ejector button on the tarmac and blew up in the flames.
Yeah. It was that kind of, it felt like a weird, like old optical comp that was really hard to do or something. But, and that those,
you reminded me about that. I forgot.
Those were not
shots, but I remembered. Yeah.
All due respect, those were not excusable. They were so bad. Like, you know, who knows why they were so bad, but I just was like, but anyway, those were the ones that really
I agree with you.
I don't know if you saw them, Jason. Did you see those, Mike?
I had forgotten about those until you just said them, and because you just said it. And I remember thinking in my head, like, okay, just not a fault of the movie in the initial part of that sequence. I was like, I wonder how many of those fireworks are real. Right? Like CG or real. I know they're blowing off fireworks or whatever, but for shot construction purposes, were there fake fireworks? That was just like a passing thought. And then,
there's a similar shot at Daytona where it's a really wide shot. They're going past the grandstand and the fireworks are going off behind the grandstand. Yeah.
Right. So the very beginning. Yeah.
The very beginning. And I looked at that shot and I'm like, and I was put out of the film by it, but I was also wondering, because you've got all this artificial light in the Daytona arena and then you've got night and then you've got fireworks. And like, it didn't seem to work.
Like an exposure problem or something?
Yeah, it was either exposure or maybe if you were there, that was what it actually looks like, but it didn't feel like
it. The scale problem too?
Well, yeah, the fireworks are very low, just right above the top of the building.
Yeah.
Yeah, where you'd expect them to be higher. But the lighting, there was no sort of contact. It was like it was like a split screen almost, you know. There was like the above the stadium fireworks, below the stadium Daytona with lighting. And I just looked at the shot, and I've seen it since in a trailer or something. And I was like, that shot looks really weird to me. And I can't work out whether it's just me and lighting, and I've never seen that, or whether it was just not comped believably. Because
they looked like tough comps, and they looked like, in terms of the camera movement, the shots at the end, the camera's moving, it's tracking back as they're kind of walking towards camera and they're really excited. The camera's tracking back with them. So they stay in frame and the camera's kind of low. So it's angled up, looking up towards them and towards the fireworks. And something about that, like it's a maybe a shot design issue. Maybe it's an exposure and lighting issue. Maybe it's just the sort of.
And also, the other thing is, they had. I mean, like, I'm not excusing that shot, but they had really limited opportunities sometimes to film where they wanted to film, and so it's conceivable, and I don't know this to be the fact, that they had to recreate that shot for some reason it didn't work. There's a shot where they're walking, like earlier in the film, where Brad Pitt, well, Sonny and Joshua are walking through the setup, and all the drivers, the real drivers, are in their cars, and they worked out they had the opportunity to do two takes of them walking along with all of these drivers and all their crew and everybody in the background kind of getting stuff set up. And on the first time they went through, a fan ran up and tried to get a selfie with Brad Pitt, right? Placing his iPhone completely between the film camera and Brad Pitt's head. And they're like, get out of shot, right? So they could obviously have two takes, so they got it on the second one. But I don't know, but it must have been, it could easily have been a situation where they tried to get a shot, they just couldn't get it, and they had to recreate it. But
sure,
I guess that's.
I mean, that's almost almost 100% the problem, or the fireworks weren't. You know, they needed that shot after everyone had they got the actual shot, but they didn't have the fireworks.
Yeah,
you know,
I just wonder, I mean, in that situation, like where, you know, time is money, you didn't get the shot, you know, you need it. Is there a better way to get that? You know, or is there a better way to get that moment and the energy of that moment, maybe with a different shot design too, where you could do something that'd be more effective?
Well, it was definitely a weaker, I mean, to be critical, if we need to be, which we do. it's certainly the weakest, like sort of celebration moment. It's a little like TV movie shot of like slow-mo.
It had a hallmark kind of level. Like, you could put it to air, but you're not really, like, putting it on your showreel. Yeah.
And I'm just talking about, like, the shot design, like, the directorial choice, not even the
execution of it. No, I'm saying, but all of that, it was like, you've, like, you need this shot, and they've kind of pulled it together, but it's not, hoping that nobody on a podcast discusses it.
Yeah, given that critique, though, like, I think it is important to just come back to the fact that, like, I think, you know, as a movie, and certainly as an effects movie, the work, like 99.7% of the work in the movie is so good and really seamless. I mean, these are minor quibbles. I'm almost like watching it thinking like, what am I going to talk about here? Like, this is so solid. What is there to critique?
I found it really funny when you watch the making ofs of the movie. They talk about, we had them in real race cars. They don't say real Formula One race cars because they were in Formula Two cars, right?
Yeah.
And so there are visual effects there to make the Formula Two look like Formula One. And, but it's one of those things, they did exactly the same thing on, like Jerry Bruckheimer is the absolute best at this. He'll like say, we had Tom in the actual fighters. He was flying.
Yeah, yeah.
And the takeout from that is he was controlling the plane, which he wasn't, right? He was a passenger in the back seat. And in this, they're like, we had them actually in the race cars. It's like not the Formula One race cars,
okay,
you understand, but Formula cars.
Yeah.
So like to that point exactly, I posted a thing on Instagram of a little like reel of Kaczynski saying, hey, just so everyone's aware, I'm paraphrasing, obviously, this movie would not be possible without visual effects. And he leaned all the way into everything we always want every director to say. Visual effects made this movie possible alongside all of our, you know, production teams and all the teams working together.
Nice.
And you're like, awesome. But then my friend messaged me and said, I saw the Academy presentation of that with Kaczynski and Bruckheimer, and Bruckheimer said the exact opposite to your point, Mike, you know, which is his job as, I mean, not saying it's right, but as like OG, like hands-on, no visual effects producer, big blockbuster guy, he's like, no, we had them in the cars and they're racing and danger and production value and whatever. So it's hilarious, you know, to sort of see that. And I guess my friend was a little disappointed that Kaczynski, which he kind of has to do with Bruckheimer, kind of toed the line a little bit and like just didn't talk.
Yeah, I think Kaczynski's done the right thing by, let's face it, a sensational group of visual effects artists that did right by him. Yeah. But it was also funny because since this film came out, as part of the promotion for it, they got Brad in an actual Formula One car. It's a F1 from 2 years or 3 years ago from McLaren, so it's not the current model. And he gets out of the car and he goes, man, that's like more than what I was driving kind of thing. And you can always hear the editors going, no, don't include that bit. Just edit it so it sounds like it's almost exactly the same as what I was doing in the movie.
That's our thing with him. Oh, go ahead, Matt.
Oh, I was just going to say that's just another point worth making, I guess, too, is, talking about the filmmaker. I mean, Joseph Kaczynski, has not had a huge career in terms of his filmography. He's done a lot of commercials and video game.
Yeah, but like what, four features?
And now, three or four, maybe five features. And
Oblivion, Tron.
Top Gun
Top Gun in this one, right? And he had some Oblivion TV stuff.
I thought Oblivion was great too. And I guess that was my point, is that I think he deserves a lot of credit for making this film work. And, I think he has definitely emerged as a guy who is an incredibly capable, highly technical, with a great eye, who's really good at making really kinetic action in his movies.
And a kind of, I'm not saying this literally, but like an on time, on budget kind of guy, as in he had to work to a very, very tight timetable of F1. Hmm. And he wasn't a prima donna. He was very focused. He got what he needed to get done, and he got it done in a disciplined fashion. Now he's had a lot of money, but nevertheless.
Yeah.
He seems like he's technical, but also not like one of those directors that's just going to keep pushing and shoot 18 versions he doesn't need just because he can. And can I ask you guys a question about the film's other visual effects? Like, they were obviously having to put in stuff to do with the environment, right? Like, we talk about the cars a lot, the environment. And one of the things that I did not care about and did not bump on is all of the product placement, because that's Formula One. Everybody's got logos everywhere, right? Did it bother you guys? Like,
no. Not at all. Apparently Apple sold $40 million worth of product placement and like ads and shit on their cars.
Because that's exactly what you do, right? It's a really great way to make money back.
Yeah.
Like,
totally.
Instead of just
a million percent
fake things, just go to actual brands and say, and also if you were a brand, like, I thought the thing that would make making this movie so much easier is, imagine you're the brand, like you're Google, who sponsor one of the major F1 teams, right? Then they go, we're going to make this F1 film. And you'd be like, so my sponsorship is getting me the fans on the weekends, but you're saying I'll get all these other exposures to my logo. We're in.
Absolutely.
Like, every other team's sponsor would be thinking, like Rolex or Tag or Heuer, whoever it is. They're all going, we get extra exposure out of this. So I doubt those sponsors had to pay anything extra, because they just got along for the ride.
Yeah, it was just the Apex Red, sponsors. Yeah. And
so Red Bull, for example, which is clearly the sponsor of Red Bull, is getting all of this Red Bull stuff associated with Brad Pitt, which quite frankly would be quite expensive for them to make a commercial and hire Brad Pitt for the commercial, right? And so suddenly they've got him, they've got their guy in Red Bull standing next to Brad Pitt in the classic VR shot.
It's a win-win.
It's got to be a win-win, but I just thought it was like so funny. Like, it was like this one occasion where I just didn't care, because I'm often bumping on massive product placement, right? And the car pulls up just as the logo shows really clearly at the front of shot, and I'm like, no, really? Yeah. Did you really need the money that badly? But here it was like, it was great.
It seemed to, in context. It seems totally appropriate. Yeah, there's never a point where it is gratuitous. But it's gratuitous in the sense of in the sport. Yeah, it's like everything has a logo on it. And it's like, well, you just kind of go with that at a certain point.
The other thing is for Apple, like Apple, to your point about being a tech company in film, like, I don't know if you guys saw WWDC this year, but that was just rife with stuff to do with Formula One. They had a Formula One-ish car that was notionally driving around the circle that is the Apple headquarters.
Oh, right.
They made lots of gags about it. And and good gags, but it was like they in the WWDC fully CG version, they had a button that made all the solar panels disappear off the roof of Apple, and that became
Craig
a Formula One track.
Giant hair.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah. Yeah, but it was like a really interesting tie-in for Apple, because I think Matt, did you mention like the monitors in that tech shop when they're looking at
The XDR and the Mac displays studios or whatever.
Yeah.
And so you kind of got...
And the close-up of the emoji even, you know.
Oh,
like,
yeah.
You know, like fun. Yeah, cool. All right, whatever. Go for it. You paid for it. You earned it.
Exactly. It's like you paid for it. It's like... Imagine you went to a Paramount film and there were just all of these Paramount mountain jokes and mountains in them. And like, you know, you'd be like, well, that's a bit on the nose. But here I was, when they're sitting there studying the tech of the, and they've got this gorgeous set of Apple monitors all up there. I'm thinking, that's like eight of them. Nice shot. Yeah. That's like, I like that.
Can I don't know if you guys caught it, but there's one shot that I was like, ugh! You know, like sort of the, Leonardo DiCaprio, like whistling at the TV meme. When Joshua's character is with his manager and they're like in their training thing and he's like running and his manager's on the scooter next to him and they're going through the woods and they go through a park. There's one shot where they're in Apple Park.
Yeah.
And they go by in the background, you can see
they're in the center of the ring.
In the center of the ring.
I noticed that too. Really? I was like,
yeah, what? You could see it in the back. So and I was weird. Like, oh,
I didn't get that.
Yeah, it's literally one shot.
The one product placement that was close to getting on the nose for me, but it wasn't quite there, is Mercedes made a special version of their streetcar, which Joshua is driving with his manager at one point, and it's got like the decals and stuff all over it. And that was like I imagine somebody said either, yeah, you want Mercedes and everything featured, then we're going to want to plug one of our cars. Or the flip side is they were like, hey, would you like to, give us some money and have a streetcar in the film? But it was a nice car. Don't get me wrong. But
yeah, nice looking car. Can I point out that I was, and I forgot that he was a visual effects supervisor on Top Gun because of Framestore, but I saw Ryan Tuthope's name come up as the visual effects supervisor. And I was like, oh, shit. And I remembered, Mike, that, besides not obviously very familiar with his work, that you and I, in 2012, went to Atomic Fiction and interviewed Ryan for an FX Guide thing about, I think, Zinc or something back in the day. And it was just sort of like, I had forgotten about it. It's when we did the thing at the ranch at 3210 with the explosions and stuff on the stage.
And the shooting. So just to unpack that for anyone listening. So
that's 2012.
In 2012, we did a thing with FX PhD where we went to the home of ILM, then Kerner Optical, and did an entire thing on practical effects. And Jason kindly was there and we were filming, guns, and we dropped a car and we did a bunch of things with fireballs and stuff. And so on that trip is what you're referring to, right? We went to...
Yeah, on that trip we went to an ILM, and interviewed Pablo Hellman, I think.
Yeah, Pablo, great guy.
That was a fun trip, but I hadn't thought about that. I had to look it up because that's the only time in VFX show history that you and I saw the movie we did the podcast about together, and we saw Looper in the theater.
Oh, wow. Really? Wow. Okay.
Yeah. The two of us.
After 25 years of doing FX Guide, now into my 26th year, I my memory isn't as good as yours, but I
don't even remember some of the movies I've seen. It's kind of sad.
Yeah.
Though Atomic Fiction, I remember that in particular, because back in the day, Atomic was a leader in their equipment room was basically a cable end of the wall because they had nothing on campus of their offices. Yeah. It was just they would have a curtain and like behind this is our equipment room, and you'd pull the curtain back and there was just one single cable going into the wall.
Yeah, I think. Yeah.
I do want to make a suggestion for Joseph Kaczynski and his team that worked on F1. Because Jason, you mentioned there was some blurb that you heard where he mentioned that he wasn't opposed to the idea of a sequel to F1 somehow. But I would say this, okay, you've done F1, you've done the Formula One universe. Now the next move would be to do the Tourist Trophy motorcycle road race on the Isle of Man. That would be an amazing movie.
I thought you were going to say the Tour de France on bicycles.
And, I mean, that would be cool too, although there'd be a lot of people injecting drugs.
If it was a historical account.
Oh, yeah. Sure. A lot less places to put cameras, yeah.
But the Tourist Trophy, if you guys have you guys have seen that, right? The motorcycle road race on the Isle of Man.
I've not watched it.
It's the most amazing and death-defying and frightening motorcycle road race, I think, in the world, maybe. And they're going at crazy high speeds on a motorbike. Yeah.
Yeah. So
that would be cool.
Yeah.
I'd pay to watch that movie.
I'm sorry, I have a thing with motorbikes. I think they're just like, I'd see a motorcyclist fly by me when I'm driving to work and I go, a temporary Australian, because every single
well they say right there's two kinds of bike riders. This includes bicycles too, but human powered bicycles, those who have crashed and those that will.
Yeah, and honestly, every person I know, including myself, who have ever been on a motorbike, have come off. And it's been, every friend of mine that's had a motorbike has had either horrendous crash or nearly horrendous crash, but they've definitely come off. And I would never let one of my children ride a bike, a motorbike. Okay, well.
And on that note.
On that note, the hope is that he makes F2. For Jason, and he makes the bike movie for Matt. Hey,
well, only with the crossover with Days of Thunder. Only that's the only acceptable.
Yeah, but please, sequel to this. I would cry if it was done in 3 years' time, and Brad was like 4 years older, and
should
Tom well, was four yeah, years I mean, older.
That's, and, that's the problem.
A crossover with Talladega Nights, that would be way better.
There you go. There you go.
Days of Thunder would be the sound of their walkers.
Yeah. The tennis balls on their walkers.
Yeah.
That we should look as good on our best day as Brad looks on his worst
Fair
day.
Enough.
Absolutely.
Let's not be ageist here. These guys.
Oh, I am nowhere near ageist.
Okay. So I really like the film. I'm so glad you guys liked it, given that you weren't quite so fanatical as fans. Hopefully, John Montgomery liked it as a completely fanatical fan. And hopefully, you're listening at home have liked our podcast. Matt, where can people connect with you?
More and more just on Letterboxd, just as Matt Wallen.
You're really liking that Letterboxd, aren't you?
It's just fun. I mean, my son and I, we do it. And then I've got a group of friends that I used to work with at different effects places, ironically, who do the same, log movies and write little reviews. And I don't know, it's just kind of fun.
Before we started recording this, dear listener, we were talking and I was lamenting the fact that I feel underwater with the amount of work I've got on. And we're doing some amazingly cool stuff, some of which I'm keen to talk to you, Jason Diamond, about with the new Blackmagic 180-degree immersive camera.
Yes, sir.
But I was saying that I'm underwater, and Matt, you had the nicest attitude to life that I'd like you to repeat now. That you said, I said, oh, I was, you know, feeling relieved, but I'm trying to get my head out, and you were like, "No, I have a new attitude to life." What was it?
Yeah, I think in the last few years, for a host of different reasons, I keep thinking about the most important thing every day is to spend as much time as possible laughing, just enjoying things and laughing.
That is going to be my new mantra.
Yeah.
As much time as possible laughing. Sometimes I get into bed and my wife just laughs at me. Anyway, Jason, when that was a quote, by the way, from Rowan Atkinson. I'm in trouble. Jason, where can people connect with you?
Anywhere you can type in Jason Diamond on these socials and my website, The Diamond Bros. And I think since the last time we did a show, we had our Tribeca premiere of our documentary. I think we did a show before that. Our documentary that my brother and I produced for our business partner, Scott, Gratchev, who directed the film. We did a feature documentary called How Dark My Love about the outsider artist Joe Coleman and his wife. It's a love story. We got 5 sold out screenings at Tribeca. We got a back by popular demand 6 screening, and we also won the audience award for Tribeca for documentary.
That's so, great. Congratulations.
Extremely proud of the film. I can't wait for everyone to see it, much less you guys here. We have some festivals coming up. As soon as we lock them, I'll say where they are. And yeah,
have you sold the documentary to
we have not sold it. Our sales agents are pounding the pavement to, you know, do work on a festival strategy as well as a distributor buyer strategy. You know, people, very, very notable names of distributors that we all would love to sell things to, have requested screeners, and we are crossing our fingers that a documentary can, you know, be as successful as a narrative feature.
Because that's the thing, isn't it? If you don't want to actually have it, I mean, you do want to sell it, obviously, but to get it into festivals, it has to be like the festival conditions to get it into the festival are that it's not in wide release, right?
Yes. I mean, yeah. You know, also, you know, a quality festival run will help a distributor go, oh, people want to see it. Like, the audience award is the award you want to win. And having sold out screenings, the distributor says, oh, people want to see this, not just the four people on the jury. Yeah. And of course, we love and respect our jury members that came to our screenings, and they were all very nice and appreciative, and we love them. But the audience award is also, you know, quite critical to sales. So that is our hope to get it into a very public distribution thing. And
as busy as I feel I am with projects, and we're doing a series for one of the big streamers, and we're doing a lot of research at my lab, I feel like you run rings around me with how much work you've got on and what you're up to.
Sometimes, maybe. I think we're comparable. But just to be fair, this documentary took 12 years to make. So it is my second 12-year documentary. They overlapped, of course. We have an 8-year documentary that we're still on right now. I mean, these things take time.
So another 4 years to go on that one.
They are, yeah. They are labors of love.
I think documentary filmmaking is infinitely harder than narrative filmmaking in a different way, in terms of the edit.
I think it certainly can be. Depends on, you know, having 12 years of footage to go through versus you know, whatever. But although I did see that to bring it back to F1 before I close it up, the editor said that they had a 2,000-to-1 ratio.
Whoa.
Because of all the all the cameras and all the, you know, coverage.
That makes sense.
Certainly not in every scene, but in the race scenes, they had some crazy ratio.
Well, that's the advantage of shooting on digital, isn't it? Imagine that in feature. I mean, you can never shoot this on film because the cameras would be too big, but
And I will echo Matt's statement and about laughing, and say a similar mantra that my good friend Mark Peterson says, who is also a former Red Center interviewee from his Off Hollywood days. Most laughs wins.
Excellent. Well, thanks so much for listening, guys. Hope you enjoyed it. We tried to build this podcast for combat. Until next time, I'm Mike Seymour. See you guys.
If you have any questions or comments, please email us at vfx@fxguide.com. Copyright FX Guide, LLC.